Well, welcome to our Purim celebration. Normally, if you've been to our Purim celebrations before, it's a little bit different, isn't it? It's usually at night, and we celebrate on the eve of Purim. And it's usually, we have a party, and it's usually very festive. We have a skit. The kids usually do a skit and act out the story of Purim. This year, however, we wanted to do things a little bit different, and we wanted it to be a little bit more of a reverent experience. In light of recent attacks in Israel and the start of the Gaza-Israeli war, we felt like it would be important for all of us and members of the community to come up and begin to read through the story of Esther, line by line, chapter by chapter, until we complete the book. And so many of you out here tonight have been given selected portions of the book of Esther. Hopefully, if you talk to Howard, he's given you some. And so we're going to take turns all reading through that. And since ancient times in the synagogues, that is what has happened in Purim, is the community comes together and will read from the actual Megillah, the Megillah of Esther, the scroll of Esther. They'll read it in Hebrew. But due to the shortage of Hebrew readers here tonight, we'll go ahead and read it in English. And we're going to retell the story. But at the end of the retelling of the story, I think it takes about 20 to 25 minutes to read through it all. I'm going to give a quick, just a few points, a few words, and then we'll break and have a meal together. It's important, though, if you're the first reader, you're welcome to come on up as you're reading. Come on up and you can have your Bible open. But if you see, like Jeremy is the first reader, if you see your portion of Scripture is coming up, your portion of the book of Esther is coming up soon, come on up here and just stand here and just be ready. And that'll help it kind of flow. And that way it won't break up the story and the narrative of the story too much. And Gabrielle is going to, she's offered to play a little bit of piano in the background for us. But before we do the reading of the Megillah, there's a traditional blessing that we recite. And it goes, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us concerning the reading, retelling of the Megillah. Amen. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who performed miracles for our forefathers in those days at this time. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has granted us life, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this occasion." So if you want to read along, Esther chapter 1 is where we're going to start tonight. Follow along as the readers are up here reading. It's really important that you get your mouth just about 2 to 3 inches away from the microphone so everyone can hear you well and that your voice can be projected really well. So feel free to move this mic stand around if you need to, if you need to lower it or raise it based on your height.
This is what happened in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 princes from India to Ethiopia. At that time, King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in the castle in Shushan. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his princes and his servants. The military leaders of Persia and Media, plus the nobles and officials of the provinces, were present. He displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty for many days, 180 days. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the garden court of the king's palace for all the people who were present in the palace of Shushan, for both the greatest to the least. There were white and blue linen curtains hung by cords of fine linen and purple on silver rings and marble columns, gold and silver couches on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, marble, mother of pearl and minerals. Wine was served in golden goblets, each of which was different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant according to the king's wealth. In keeping with the law, there were no restrictions on drinking, for the king had instructed the supervisors of his household to comply with each person's desire. In addition, Queen Vashti held a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry from the wine, he commanded Mehuman, Mizetha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who attended Ahasuerus the king, to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing the royal crown. He wanted to show the peoples and the officials her beauty, for she was very attractive. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command and conveyed by the eunuchs. Then the king became furious and burned with anger.
So the king consulted the wise man who discerned the times, for it was the king's practice to consult experts in matters of law and justice. Those closest to him were the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and were the highest in the kingdom. By law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti for failing to obey the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? Then Memucan answered in the presence of the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and peoples who are in all the provinces of the king. For the queen's conduct will go out to all the women, making their husbands contemptible in their eyes, by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she would not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the matter concerning the queen will respond similarly to all the king's princes, and there will be no end to the contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal commandment go forth from him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, with that which cannot be repealed, that Vashti may not come into the presence of the king, and let the king give her royal status to another who is more worthy than she. Then the king's edict, which he will enact, will be proclaimed throughout all his vast kingdom, and all of the wives will give their husbands honor from the greatest to the smallest. The matter pleased the king and the princes, so the king did according to the word of Memucan. He sent letters throughout all the royal provinces to each province in its own script and to each people in its own language, that every man should be in charge of his own household and speak the language of his own people.
A while later, when King Xerxes' anger had subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what he had been decreed against her. The king's servants attending him said, a search should be made for young, good-looking virgins. The king should appoint officials in all the province of the kingdom to gather all the young, good-looking virgins to the house of the harem in Shushan, the capital. They should be put under the care of Haggai, the king officer in charge of the women, and he should give them their cosmetics that they require. Then the girl who seems best to the king should become queen instead of Vashti. This proposal pleased the king, so he acted accordingly. There was in Shushan, the capital, a man who was a Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shema, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. He had been exiled from Jerusalem with the captives, exiled in Jehoiakim, king of Yehuda, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, had carried off. He had raised Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, because she had neither father nor mother. The girl was shapely and good-looking. After her father and mother's death, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. When the king's order and decree were proclaimed, and many girls assembled in Shushan, the capital, under the care of Haggai, Esther, too, was taken into the king's house and put under the care of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. The girl pleased him and won his favor, so that he lost no time in giving her cosmetics, her portions of special food, and seven girls from the king's palace to attend her. He also promoted her and the girls attending her to the best place in the harem's quarters. Esther did not disclose her people or family ties, because Mordecai had instructed her not to tell anyone. Every day, Mordecai would walk around in front of the courtyard of the harem's house in order to know how Esther was doing and what was happening to her.
Each girl had her turn to appear before King Ahasuerus after she had undergone the full 12-month period preparation prescribed for the women, consisting of a 6-month treatment with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and other cosmetics for women. Then when the girl went to see the king, whatever she wanted would be given to her as she went from the harem's house to the king's palace. She would go in the evening, and on the following day she would return to another part of the harem's house and be under the care of Shashgaz, the king's officer and in charge of the concubines. She would not go to the king again unless he was especially pleased with her and had summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, whom Mordecai had adopted as his own daughter, to appear before the king, she didn't ask for anything other than what Haggai, the king's officer in charge of the harem, advised. Yet Esther was admired by all who saw her. She was brought to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, Tevet, during the 7th year of his reign. The king liked Esther more than any of his wives. None of the other virgins obtained such favor and approval from him. So he put the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti.
The king then gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all his officers and servants, decreed a holiday for the provinces, and distributed gifts worthy of royal bounty. When the girls would gather on other occasions, Mordecai would sit at the king's gate. Esther had not yet revealed her family ties or her people, as Mordecai had ordered her, for Esther continued obeying what Mordecai had told her to do, as she had when he was raising her. On one of those occasions, when Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, two of the king's officers, Bigtan and Teresh, from the group in charge of the private entryways, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Ahasuerus. But Mordecai learned about it and told Esther the queen. Esther reported it to the king, crediting Mordecai. The matter was investigated, found to be true, and both were hanged on a stake. All this was recorded in the daily journal that was kept with the king.
After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him, set him seat above all the princes that were with him, all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and revered Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him any kind of revering. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why transgressed thou the king's commandments?" Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman said that Mordecai showed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai, wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, the lot before Haman, from day to day and from month to month till the 12th month, that is, the month of Adar.
And Haman said unto the king Ahasuerus, that there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not for them the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemies. And the king said unto Haman, "The silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as thee seemeth good to thee." Then were the king's scribes called unto on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people in every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus, was it written and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed.
Wow.
when Mordecai learned everything that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out through the city, lamenting and crying bitterly. He stopped before the king, entering the king's gate, since no one was allowed to go inside the king's gate wearing sackcloth. In every province reached by the king's order and decree, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, as many lay down on sackcloth and ashes. When the girls and officials attending Esther came and informed her of this, the queen became deeply distressed. She sent clothes for Mordecai to wear instead of his sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept them. So Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's officials attending her, and instructed him to go to Mordecai and find out what this was all about and why. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open space in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, exactly how much silver Haman had promised to put in the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the decree for their destruction issued in Shushan, so that I could show it to Esther, explain it to her, and then instruct her to approach the king, intercede with him, and implore his favor on behalf of her people. Hathach returned and told Esther what Mordecai had said.
Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him.
On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters. While the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite to the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. He held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." The idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made.
During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found that Mordecai had reported about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, and that they had sought to attack the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing else has been done for him." So the king said, "Who is in the courtyard?" Now Haman had just entered the outer courtyard of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the wooden gallows, which he had prepared for him. So the king's servant said to him, "Behold, Haman is standing in the courtyard." And the king said, "Have him come in." Haman then came in, and the king said to him, "What is it to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king desire to honor more than me?" Therefore Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, have them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal turban has been placed. Then order them to hand the robe and the horse over to one of the king's noble officials, and have them dress the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'So it shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Quickly, take the robe and the horse just as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew who is sitting in the king's gate. Do not fail to do anything of all that you have said." So Haman took the robe and the horse and dressed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "So it shall be done for the man whom the king desires to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, while Haman hurried home, mourning, with his head covered. And Haman informed Zeresh his wife and all his friends of everything that had happened to him. Then his wise man and Zeresh his wife said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you shall not prevail over him, but will certainly fall before him." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared.
So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet, and the queen again said to Esther at the wine banquet, "Whatever you request, Queen Esther, you will be granted it. Whatever you want up to have the kingdom, it will be done." Esther the queen answered, "If I have won your favor, king, and if it pleases the king, then what I ask be given me is my own life and the lives of my people. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, killed, and exterminated. If we had only been sold as men and women slaves, I would have remained quiet. Since then, our trouble would not have been worth the damage it would have caused the king to alter the situation." King Xerxes asked Esther the queen, "Who is he? Where is the man who dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "A ruthless enemy. It's this wicked Haman Haman stood aghast, terrified before the king and queen. In a rage, the king got up from the wine banquet and went out to the palace garden. But Haman remained, pleading with Esther, the queen, to spare his life, for he could see that the king had decided to do him in. Haman had just fallen on the couch where Esther was when the king returned from the palace garden to the wine banquet. He shouted, "Is this even going to rape the queen here in the palace before my very eyes?" The moment these words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Harvana, one of the king's attendants, said, "Look, the gallows 75 feet high that Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke only good for the king, is standing at Haman's house." The king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's anger subsided.
On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who were in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows, because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke."
On the 23rd day of the third month, that is the month Sivan, the royal scribes were summoned. Everything was written exactly as Mordecai ordered for the Jews, to the satraps, the governors, and officials of the 127 provinces from India to Kush. The edict was written for each province in its own script, for each ethnic group in its own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in King Ahasuerus' name, and sealed the edicts with the royal signet ring. He sent the documents by mounted couriers, who rode fast horses bred from the royal racing mares. The king's edict gave the Jews in each and every city the right to assemble and defend themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate every ethnic and provincial army hostile to them, including women and children, and to take their possessions as spoils of war. This would take place on a single day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month Adar. A copy of the text, issued as law throughout every province, was distributed to all the peoples, so the Jews could be ready to avenge themselves against their enemies on that day. The couriers rode out in haste on their royal horses at the king's urgent command. The law was also issued in the fortress of Susa. Mordecai went from the king's presence clothed in royal purple and white with a great gold crown, and a purple robe of fine linen. The city of Susa shouted and rejoiced, and the Jews celebrated with gladness, joy, and honor. In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his law reached, joy and rejoicing took place among the Jews. There was a celebration and a holiday. Many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews because fear of the Jews had overcome them.
The time approached for the king's order and decree to be carried out, the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to overpower them. But as it turned out, the opposite took place. The Jews overpowered those who hated them. Thus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, on the month of Adar, the Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the province of King King Achashverosh to attack anyone who tried to do them harm. And no one was able to withstand them, because all the people were afraid of them. All the officials of the province, the army commanders, the governors, and those occupied with the king's affairs helped the Jews, because they were afraid of Mordecai. For Mordecai had become a powerful person in the king's palace, and his fame had spread through all the provinces. Mordecai continued to grow increasingly powerful. The Jews put all their enemies to the sword. There was a great slaughter and destruction, as they did whatever they wanted to those who hated them. In Shushan, the capital, the Jews slaughtered 500 men. They put to death the 10 sons of Haman, the sons of Hamdatha, the enemy of the Jews. Parshandata, Dalphon, Ashpada, Porata, Adalia, Aridata, Parmashta, Arishai, Aridai, and Vaizata. But they did not touch the spoil. The same day after the king had been told the number of those killed in Shushan, the capital, he said to Esther, the queen, "If the Jews have slaughtered 500 men in Shushan, the capital, and 10 sons of Haman, what have they done in the rest of the royal provinces? Now, whatever your request, you will be granted it. Whatever more you want, it will be done." Esther replied, "If it pleases the king, let the Jews in Shushan act again tomorrow in accordance with today's decree. Also have Haman's 10 sons hanged on the gallows." The king ordered these things done. A decree was issued in Shushan, and they hang Haman's 10 sons. So the Jews in Shushan assembled also on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men of Shushan. But they did not touch the spoil.
Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Shusha gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th, and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast poor, that is, cast lots, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim after the term Pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what that had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year. That these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation in every clan, province, and city,
and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants.
Then Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter about Purim. And he sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, namely words of peace and truth, to establish these days of Purim at their appointed times, just as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had established for them, and just as they had established for themselves and for their descendants with instructions for their times of fasting and their lamentations. And the command of Esther established these customs for Purim and is written in the book.
Now King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the land, even to its farther shores, and all of Mordecai's powerful and magnificent accomplishments, together with full account of his greatness to the king, had raised him, and they are not written in the book in the chronicles of the king of Media and Persia. For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and was highly favored by his many kinsmen, seeking the good of his people and seeking peace to all his countrymen.
Wow, what a story. Thank you for those who read. Thank you for Gabrielle playing music. As I was reading the story of Esther this morning and praying about what to speak on, I just wanted to share about 10 or 12 minutes with you guys some thoughts that I had typed out. A couple verses jumped out at me, and especially with recent events in mind, the things that happened in Israel of Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles last year. Two verses really stood out to me as I reread it this morning. In Esther chapter 3, verse 12 to 13, destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, from young to old, children and women, on a single day. Now, if we compare that to the end of the story and the Jewish response to the attempted annihilation, Esther chapter 8, verse 11 reads very similar, but also very different. It goes, destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. Anti-Semitism is the baseless hatred of anyone of Jewish descent. Anti-Semitism comes in many forms and takes on many faces. It can look like socialist nationalism, as we saw with the Nazi Party. It can look like Islamic jihadism. Can look like anti-Zionism or Christian replacement theology. Anti-Semitism is timeless. It's a timeless satanic idea that has infiltrated and permeated the darkest chapters of our human history. As an idea, it supposes everything from the Jews are less evolved than we are as humans to the Jews control the financial systems of the world and are hoarding money and power for themselves. Sadly, the tentacles of this idea have wormed their way into some of the most unsuspecting times and places. As an idea, it ebbs and flows in its popularity over time, like an infection or an abscess in the body of humanity. It eventually comes to a head and spews its nastiness across the disenfranchised and angry masses in an effort to recruit them to do its dirty work. Anti-Semitism has possessed many a world leader, many a theologian, and many religions. We are all somewhat familiar with the cyclical nature of this idea and the atrocities committed against Jews because of it. Anti-Semitism reared its satanic and destructive head on October 7th of last year, on the Jewish holiday of Simchat Torah, the final and most joyous day of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. In the early morning hours of October 7th, at least 1,500 members of Hamas, the Islamic government of Gaza, broke through approximately 30 spots on the Gaza-Israeli border wall and pillaged 20 residential communities near the border. Some terrorists arrived either by car, motorcycles, or paragliders. Under the cover of rocket attacks from inside Gaza, and knowing the typical response of locals would be to hide in bomb shelters, the militants arbitrarily set fire to many homes and community centers and shot anyone who tried to flee. Grenades were hurled into safe rooms and bunkers. Women were repeatedly raped. Infants were beheaded, and those of interest were taken into captivity into Gaza's vast tunnel system. Around 240 in all would be used as human shields and tools of leverage. Many militants wore cameras to record the atrocities to serve as trophies and bragging rights upon their return to Gaza. Some were recorded on those cameras, calling their families and bragging on how many Jews Allah permitted them to kill that day. The attack launched from Gaza by members of the militant wing of Hamas had, at face value, very little significance or strategic benefit for the people of Gaza. There was no territory gain on the map. Tens of thousands of elite Hamas fighters would be killed in the retaking of Israeli towns and the invasion of Gaza, which would ensue months to follow. And villages, and Hamas essentially kicked the hornet's nest, that is, Israeli defense forces. There is one strategic outcome, however, that is worth far more to Hamas than gaining any territory or racking up a large body count. That is, the potential seismic shift in the world's opinion of Israel and their response to the conflict. Hamas knew exactly what must be done to solicit a swift and violent response from the Israeli military. That response is all they needed to then wage an all-out information war, a war of ideas. Frankly, from my assessment, Hamas is winning that information war and has been for most of the conflict. The front lines of the information war is waged on social media and cable news outlets. Hamas leaders knew the timing of an attack like this was perfect. It was the last day of Sukkot, a Sabbath, and a day on which many IDF soldiers would be off duty visiting their families throughout the country, a day in which communication would be stifled by many religious Jews having powered off their phones. On a broader scale, they knew the timing was perfect because the U.S., Israel's greatest political and military ally, is already sending in any liquidable cash to the black hole that is the war in Ukraine. With a leader whose mental acuity is waning faster than a knife fight in a phone booth, Hamas knew that the U.S. was not going to commit boots on the ground. Being an election year for the U.S., Hamas knew that the rapidly growing Muslim populations in swing states such as Minnesota and Michigan would keep President Biden's pro-Israel sentiments in check. And without the U.S.'s full backing to wage total and complete war against Hamas, Israel would potentially need to make the decision to give over land, release Palestinian prisoners, or keep fighting in Gaza with the risk of losing support of major world leaders. For Israel, it became the classic damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. In an age of Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and leftist anti-Semitic news outlets, Hamas calculated the cost and determined it would be a worthwhile effort, something they did not factor into their calculation. But is indeed playing in their favor is the fact that Americans could care less about Israel's supposed divine election by God, as the Bible clearly states. Why? Because we in the United States of America for decades now have taught that the Bible is simply mythology. Our biblical ethics and understanding has been waning, and waning rapidly. Even within the halls of large churches and denominations, it is often taught that Israel is, theologically speaking, the forgotten stepchild of God's will and plan for humanity. And sadly, many Christian denominations have, for the past 2,000 years, taught that Israel is in theological timeouts. So most Americans see a 15-second clip of a weeping Gazan woman dislodging their children from rubble, and we automatically pick a side, the side of the supposed victims. Out of our inch-deep compassion and a love for virtue signaling, we then decide to repeat genocidal tropes like, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Or we swoon over actors and actresses wearing bloody hand lapel pins to the Oscars, lapel pins that are inherently linked to the lynching of two IDF reservists in Ramallah back in October of 2000. Americans are so quick to run to the aid of the supposed underdog, and in doing so, we forget that the underdog isn't always the one in the right. Our culture worships at the altar of victimhood. And we have forgotten and forsaken the very words of our Creator, as penned by the prophet Zechariah, "He who touches you, O Jerusalem, touches the apple of my eye." Hamas and its religious and political allies knew that the time was right, The iron was hot. If ever they wanted the world to shift its perspective on Israel and its right to exist, the time was now. They knew better than anyone else that Hamas did not need to gain territory on the ground. They just needed to gain territory in the public eye. Yes, they have the blood of tens of thousands of Gazan and civilians on their hands, but their idea of hatred is what fuels them. And that was a sacrifice they were willing to make. Just like Haman in the story of Esther, their motives are not rational. Like the rest of fundamental Islam in the Quran, these ideas have spawned from the pits of hell and are in direct confrontation with the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. Now Hamas has forced the hand of Israel and its leaders. And as the world watches on, Israel has unleashed the full fury and might of its superior weaponry against the terrorist organization as it hides beneath schools and hospitals and mosques and then emerges only to count the bodies of their deceased children and grandmothers and then to steal the humanitarian aid sent to them and cry victim to the world's media outlets. They know, arguably more than Israel's leaders do, that their struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and against authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against spiritual forces in the heavenly realms. They know that they can play the victim, and the world at this time will buy it. The world will look at buildings in Gaza being leveled and repeat idiotic ideas such as the once oppressed are now the oppressors, or Israel is committing ethnic or religious genocide against Muslims. Jews have been on the run in every continent of the world since the beginning of the Roman diaspora 2,000 years ago. Jews made up significant population groups in not only every European nation, but in many Muslim-majority Middle Eastern countries until the turn of the 20th century. Only in the early 20th century did British-ruled Palestine offer a bastion of freedom and safety for the Jewish people. The ancestral lands of the Jewish people were once again available to them post the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which was a Muslim caliphate, which prevented a Jewish resettlement. Nations such as Yemen, Morocco, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, and Turkey all boasted significant Jewish communities and now have nearly zero. Yet, Israel is responsible for genocide. Sadly, ideas such as anti-Semitism or Islamic jihadism can never be fully eradicated with the sword. But how do you defeat an enemy who looks into the barrel of a gun and sees paradise? Ideally, evil ideas are best combated and defeated solely with better ideas, or we could say the truth. But as we see in the book of Esther, defeating evil sometimes requires the less ideal combination of both the sword and better ideas. The truth plus blunt force. Until then, the stage is being set across the world to bring several nations to war against Israel. A war foretold by the prophets. A war which will test the motives and the hearts of all humanity. A war in which the King of Kings will prove victorious. Destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children to plunder the property of their enemies. Notice the differences. In Esther chapter 3, one is a war that is unethical. But in Esther chapter 8, one is a war that is ethical. One attempts to preserve innocent life, and the other has no regard for life at all. One celebrates death, and the other lives to preserve all innocent life. So the question I pose for you on this day of Purim 2024 is, are you willing to take a stand for the people of God in the face of certain death? Are you promoting the ideas espoused by a secularist or pro-jihadist group? Or are you standing on the promises of God? Are you willing to audit what media you are allowing to inform you? Is your source of truth the timeless words of God? Or are they the likes of Rachel Maddow or the Young Turks or other simple-minded personalities you might find on TikTok or the like? Are you, like the people of Shushan, going to believe in misinformation? Or you trust in God's word when it says that he will bring Israel back from the four winds and replant her in his land, never again to be uprooted? Let me be clear. This is not a wholesale endorsement of the government and the people of Israel. Just like any nation, there are failures and there are faults. Just like in the story of Esther, God seems distant at times. The people don't seem to be seeking the kingdom first and foremost. No one in the story of Esther prays. No one even utters the name of God in this entire story. Much unlike the book of Daniel. In the story of Esther, everyone is primarily known by their pagan names, even though they have Hebrew names. But oddly enough, the essence of the story of Esther and the story of Purim is this. Even though his people are not seeking his will or his face, he is still faithful to them. But still, we know, just as in the story of Esther, God will cause the enemies of Israel to fall into their own trap that they leave set for the people of Israel. As the story of Esther concludes, the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. So may it be for us. When God's kingdom comes and his throne is permanently established in Jerusalem, I want to be found on the right side of history, that I too may have light and gladness, joy and honor. My prayer is that you'll desire the same. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, she'oso nisim la'avoseinu bayomim chokem bizman hazeh. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who performed miracles for our forefathers in those days at this time. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, shehakianu v'kimayonu v'higianu lizman hazeh. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has granted us life, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this occasion. Father, may you protect your people. May you bring peace through the Prince of Peace. And may you once again dwell with us soon and in our days. Amen.